This episode is brought to you by Severn Films. Severn Films presents a trio of Euro Terrors on Blu-ray for Halloween. From the director of Contamination and Star Crash, Luigi Cozzi, comes Paganini Horror, starring Dario Nicoletti and Donald Pleasence. This is the first official release ever in America, limited edition 3,000 copies, and it comes with a remastered soundtrack CD. Also for the first time in America, the 1961 Italian lycanthrope classic Werewolf in a Girl's Dormitory, Director's Cut, limited edition of 3,000 with vintage comic book reprint and soundtrack CD. The extras include a commentary with star Kurt Lowens and an interview with screenwriter Ernesto Gastaldi. And finally, another U.S. distribute, the hot German cut of Eurocult Sleazathon, Belith, the Demon of Incest, never before in HD and never forgotten once seen. Get all three on Blu-ray from SevernFilms.com in a special bundle or separately. That's www.severin-films.com. Follow Severn Films on social media for the new release announcements and all these special offers. This week's episode is also sponsored by our friends at RLJE Films. Don't miss the terrifying thriller Mary, starring Gary Oldman and Emily Mortimer. Mary is coming to select theaters, VOD, and digital today, Friday, October 11th, and is available now on Apple TV. Check out Mary. Okay, welcome to episode 163 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, and I'm flying solo today. This is dropping kind of in the middle of while we're all traveling to Salem, to Knoxville. We're going to be all over the place this month. But the opportunity arose to interview this gentleman, and I jumped at the chance because I've always wanted to have him on the show, and we've got so much to talk about, including his new movie. So welcome to the show, Patrick Lussier.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
All right. Yeah, and so, I mean, this is perfect timing for Halloween season. You made a movie called Trick, and it comes out on October 18th, and it's reuniting you and Todd Farmer. You guys have kind of worked together quite a lot lately.
Yeah.
But where did this movie come from? Because on the way up here to record, we're actually in Ernie's studio. Shout out to Ernie. I told you that this movie to me is – if I was a 12-year-old right now and I looked at John Carpenter's Halloween poster with the pumpkin face and the knife, this is the movie I imagine that poster would be. And it's not. I mean, John Carpenter's movie is great and it's a different thing. This delivers on the pumpkin-faced like knife killer in a certain way. So, weird compliment, I know.
Yeah, no, I'll totally take it. Any compliment's not weird. It's just like, oh, God, thank you for not saying I suck today. yeah, it's, you know, Todd and I, you know, we obviously were involved in the briefly in the Halloween franchise a few years ago. We were going to do Halloween 3D, a sequel to Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
Oh, wow.
So we had we were literally 5 weeks away from shooting it. This movie Trick has nothing to do with that.
Okay.
None of what we wrote for that is in this, but we had, you know, obviously walked down the territory of that particular holiday. And you know, we had locations, we had cast locked in, we had Tom Atkins was going to be on that one as well.
I know.
Playing a great psychiatrist who ended up getting his head cut off in a fish tank and having it float at you in 3D. It was going to be glorious. But
we'll get to all that.
Yeah. So then Trick started, you know.
You said Halloween on the brain.
Yeah, we had it on the brain since then. And he and I just started spitballing and talking about sort of the slasher movies that we really liked. I think in the wake of Drive Angry, which was a movie that is all sorts of different things, we decided to make a movie that was just one thing.
Yeah.
going back to what we learned in My Bloody Valentine, which is, have your movie be one thing.
Yeah.
So we just leant into it and wanted to do, a killer that was – both iconic on one hand, and yet had wasn't necessarily the stalker that is relentless in a way that, you know, like Jason or Michael Myers or things like that. Somebody had a sort of different quirk to them.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean it's got a lot of those. What I like about it is it's got a lot of those elements. I was telling you before it feels like it's in the post Scream, at least in terms of the. I mean, it gets pretty gnarly in terms of the kills and stuff like that. So it feels like that post-Scream world where, and again, I know you worked on the Scream movies, like those kills got pretty graphic at one point, but this is played more straightforward. It's not like funny or winking at the camera in that regard. So what were some of the influences you were kind of going for with Trick? Because it also feels very straightforward in terms of, I mean, of course, things reveal themselves as you go along, but from the get-go, it's like, hey, here's this kid in a mask, went nuts, and he's evil. That's,
yeah,
you know,
it's
pretty straightforward.
It's pretty simple. It's still like, you know, high school kid gone bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the perfect kid next door who goes crazy with no explanation, and then is revealed that has maybe a past that is a little more enigmatic than all his friends and everything originally thought. So, you know, I think part of that thing that we wanted to do in having, you know, Trick, this killer, and having that name and come up with that sort of post-Scream thing. Scream was definitely a big influence. We talked about that. We talked about, you know, so many of the slasher films, and we even talked about this back in My Bloody Valentine, is the thing that they are first and foremost are murder mysteries.
Yeah.
You know, there is that. So that we really wanted to do sort of a quote unquote slasher noir sort of thing, you know, have the detective and the cops be a huge part of the story. You know, have our sort of our troika of investigators, you know, Omar Epps's character, Ellen Adair's character, and Christina Reyes's character, you know, that those three are very much the heroes of the piece. Mm-hmm. And how that fits into applying then that, you know, that troika of characters, how they navigate through the slasher kind of story, and what they discover along the way. But, you know, the mystery element, that's, you look at everything really but Halloween, you know, the original Halloween, John Carpenter's, is not a mystery. You know, yeah. You know what it is from the beginning. But like Prom Night and Terror Train and Valentine, Happy Birthday to Me, you know, they all have that Scream, obviously, that was its big thing, was it was a mystery.
Yeah.
So we wanted to lean into that component of it.
Yeah, yeah. I remember every year that Scream, because the sequels came out pretty quickly, and it was a big event again because horror was kind of on the downslope. And then when Scream came, like every year, it was going to the theater being like, I wonder who the killer is this time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because they definitely like built up that mystery angle to it. Talk a little bit about Todd, you know, because you guys have done a couple of movies together, but you do write. You've written, and we'll delve into that. But he seems to be kind of your creative, collaborative partner. Where did you guys meet, and what was it about him that just locked in terms of like a creative collaboration?
You know, Todd and I first met back when I was brought in to do some recutting and visual, quote unquote, consulting, whatever that means. Basically, writing and Phantom directing some reshoots on a movie called Darkness Falls, which was a killer Tooth Fairy movie.
I remember.
So it was a movie that when I was involved had no Tooth Fairy in it, and it was just like, oh, scary shadows, and we added a Tooth Fairy.
There's two Tooth Fairy, because I remember McFarlane Toys did a Tooth Fairy.
Right. And I never saw any footage of that monster.
Huh.
Of the original Steve Wang, I think.
Yeah.
Never saw any footage of it. But worked with Stan and we designed the new monster and the mask and things like that. I have one of the masks at my house. So, cool. You know, that with all the teeth in it and stuff like that. But we met as I was finishing that. He was coming into Revolution at the time doing writing a film called Scarecrow. Which ultimately was made with neither of us involved as a movie called The Messengers.
That's right.
So we met on that. I was the original director when it was about a scarecrow that may be making this guy go crazy. It was sort of The Shining on a farm, on a sunflower farm. In the original script, it was a corn, but I had changed it to sunflowers, which I think is even in the final, because that was – I have this picture of my son when he was like 4 years old, 3 years old, in front of these massive sunflowers. And I just always – that I remember showing that, saying we should make it about sunflowers. Whatever. But that's how we met, and then we just became friends. We pitched a variety of things after that. You know, we pitched a version of Hills Have Eyes to Wes that they already had a version that they wanted to go, but you know, we did that together.
So it was kind of instantaneous, like
we just got along really well. Yeah, and spitballing different shit, and you know, the way you do, right? Yeah, I find every story starts as a series of what ifs.
Yeah,
right. What if in 30 what ifs later you have an actual movie? So this was just we would have what ifs about all sorts of things. We wrote this insanely huge underwater ghost story that would have I remember pitching it to somebody who said, we love this, but this would bankrupt our company to make it. So that was perhaps ill-conceived, but tremendous fun to write because it was so massive. But at the end of the day, it was just a ghost story.
Yeah.
It just happened to be underwater.
Wow. And you mentioned Wes Craven. When did you first work with Wes? Was it back – all the way back on – was it Nightmare Cafe?
Nightmare Cafe, yeah. I met Wes on that. I co-edited the pilot. Wes was doing People Under the Stairs at the time, so he wasn't up for the pilot. He wrote it, co-wrote it with Tom Baum, based on an idea by his son, Jonathan. And so Philip Noyce directed the pilot, and I co-edited that. And just after I finished – editing on MacGyver for 3 years. And then from that, Wes came in to do this actual series. We did 5 episodes. I ended up cutting his episode, which was a great piece of cinema called Aliens Ate My Lunch, about a little alien stealing cows because they are hooked on milk.
Nice.
Because, you know, why not? Which he loved, and I think that may have been the episode where the network was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
But he just said, I want you to cut my next feature, and that ended up being, you know, Wes Craven's New Nightmare 2 years later, and I moved from Vancouver down to Los Angeles and then did a variety of things for him, you know, after that, Vampire in Brooklyn and the first 3 Scream movies, Music of the Heart, Cursed, Red Eye.
Oh my God, so many.
and the last thing I did, like 3 or 4 weeks for him right after Valentine opened on My Soul to Take.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
25-8, as I remember it originally being called.
Yes, 25-8 is what it was originally called. And the original version is way different than what was released.
Yeah.
Like incredibly different and much more supernatural yeah,
it's a wonderful oddity, and I haven't revisited it in a long time.
Yeah.
It's on Vudu in 3D, and I have a 3D TV. Yeah. I'm going to get all into 3D in a little bit. So I'm dying to revisit it and watch it in 3D, even though I know it's a post-convert.
It's totally post-convert because it totally wasn't shot that way, and Wes had no interest in making it that way. And they're like, oh, they want to make it 3D. they did. But it was an interesting experience because I read many versions of that script, and many were very, very different than what was released.
Wow.
But Cursed was the same. You know, Cursed was aptly named.
As I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah, I was supposed to be on that show for 6 weeks. I was on it for 19 months.
Wow.
And I came in right near the end of the original shoot, and they had shot for, I think, 53 days. And then they did another reshoot that was 45 days.
Oof.
Then another one, I think it was 17 days, and then maybe 12 days, and maybe 9 days. And of the original 53 days of photography, there are 12 minutes of that in the final film.
Oh, my God.
It's a crazy bit of business, that film.
Somebody needs to write a book about that whole era.
Yeah.
of Dimension Films. But so do those – I'm curious, do those original – visions, those director's cut, if you want to call it, for things like Curse and My Soul to Take, do they still exist anywhere? Are they on a hard drive somewhere or anything like that?
Well,
hypothetically?
Hypothetically, they could be on a hard drive. I, somewhere in storage, have VHS outputs of the all three of the primary Kirst versions.
Wow.
Of the that original version, the Skeet Ulrich, Mandy Moore, Omar Epps version of the movie. That had Robert Forster and Ileana Douglas and all these other people in it that aren't in the final version. My Soul to Take, I've seen them. I don't have them. But yeah, they definitely exist. They're definitely out there.
I'm putting it out there to the universe to go look for these things because I think they deserve to be found. Going back a little bit even before that, so your entryway into the business, I mean, did you start out as an editor? Was that kind of the primary thing?
Yeah.
Was that the goal or did you just want to get into movies somehow?
I always wanted to make movies, direct movies, but editing I loved. I loved that in college and had an opportunity to starting in Vancouver, I was an assistant editor on 21 Jump Street.
Oh, man.
And in The Hitchhiker, which is an old HBO show, which is basically yuppies run amok. 23 minutes of how much violence and nudity can you cram in for all these Cofield yuppies doing havoc to each other.
Yeah.
It was a very strong morality tale about the 80s.
When
I was on MacGyver, a couple of days after my son was born, so this was back in 1989, I got a chance to move up to editing and started editing on MacGyver and did that and always had an interest in the genre, but there, you know, at the time it was just paying your bills and it was a great job. I mean, MacGyver was great fun and finished MacGyver, got onto Nightmare Cafe, which changed everything. You know, working for West changed everything. So,
well, I know people. I don't think editors get enough credit. It really is magic when you could take a bunch of footage or whatever it is and really craft a moment, whether it's a scare, a laugh, whatever it is.
Absolutely,
it's really beautiful because when you're on. It's funny. I've been on a few sets, and it's like. Everyone there is always like, I have no idea how this is going to turn out.
Yeah.
Like, it feels cool, but I have no idea.
Because it could go either way. I worked with a producer years ago who would say, a DP can make your movie look good. An editor can save your picture. can actually turn it into something it is not.
Yeah.
That was always a thing that I loved. I loved the process of seeing things come together. Working with Wes for a lot of years because he had been an editor before and had done all sorts of, the final cut of the original Friday the 13th. I remember him telling me that he and Sean Cunningham went and recut the film over a weekend before they finished it.
Wow.
So that he was one of the, uncredited editors on that.
I hope he didn't edit the boiling tea in real time sequence of Friday the 13th, which was insane.
That I couldn't answer.
90 minutes, folks. Let's just watch her boil water.
Yeah, but who knows? Sadly, Wes's that secret went with him, but maybe.
Yeah.
He was always one to watch those kind of things and how those things work.
Well, I get a sense in the films you directed that there is a lot of Wes in them, obviously, because you guys work together so closely. So, I mean, what were some of the lessons you learned sitting and editing with him?
There's so many. I mean, I would sit with Wes for years and just grill him constantly about, oh, why did you do this? And why is that? And what did you think this meant? And you just learned a practical sense of filmmaking as well as a sort of a deeper story sense. Mm. Wes, so many of his films have to do with the sins of the family.
Yeah.
Sins that happen at home and how that's sort of the scariest place to exist. That the person next door is usually far more frightening than the monster that isn't real. So that was a lot of his, I think his upbringing and how he grew up and he had a great sort of philosophical approach to the genre. Mm. And then a really great practical filmmaking tips, just from as simple as make sure you have a plan and make sure you share it with everyone so everybody knows that somebody has a plan to get them home at the end of the day.
Yeah.
because that's your job. You have to be responsible not just to the film and to the money and to everything else, but to everybody who you've dragged on board to make it. Mm-hmm. You owe them as much as you owe the people who are paying you. So, and I always took that very much to heart. And Wes was always very kind. You know, he was a good, he treated people fairly. He always valued opinions of whoever came in. I've tried to take that, you know, with me. And filmmaking is a great collaborative experience. So it's don't assume your ideas are always the best. You know, as a director, it's your job to mediate the creative ideas of others. You know, and be the creative traffic cop. So don't be afraid to be that. Don't be afraid to encourage other people to bring their best work.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the sole owner of every single moment of every single frame. And even if you say you are, odds are very good that you are not.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard a great story. I think it was on – I did the commentary on like Bordello Blood, one of the films from the movie.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank on his name. I think it's Celia Katz who – was a big part of the show and worked with Zemeckis a lot. And he just told this great story that like, for example, there is a Tales from the Crypt where they edit in Humphrey Bogart, like from old footage and stuff like that. And Zemeckis directed it. And it was kind of his trial run for Forrest Gump, like figuring out how to put – and basically he's like – he just showed up to set and he's like, all right, guys, how are we going to do this? Like with everybody like, this is what I want to do, but let's all talk about it and figure out how are we going
to
do it.
Yeah, like, and that's the best way to do it. It's, and that's how you come up with so many great solutions and how people feel – encouraged to take ownership, you know, is in any film that you make, there are so many people that have their fingerprints all over it. And the more you partner with them and, you know, really act, as you should as a coach, just, you know, helping people bring their best, in every department, the better the film will be, you know, from costumes to set design to craft service. It doesn't matter what it is, but you know, appreciate everybody for what they do.
Yeah. No, it takes a village for sure. You know, the thing I loved about Wes was he took wild swings, especially when you started working with him. Wild. New Nightmare, Vampire Brooklyn, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I always loved his philosophical approach too. But the point being is, because you worked with him for so long, did you get a sense when the first Scream was happening, when you were putting it together, like, holy shit, this is probably going to change everything? Because it did. But I always wonder when you're in the room, does it feel like something's about to change?
You know, the first Scream, and it's a story I've told many times, and I think Wes has told it as well, is, you know, the first thing they shot in the movie was the Drew Barrymore sequence. So first 5 days of dailies was that 13-minute sequence. And the Weinsteins hated the dailies, hated. We're ready to fire Wes. We're sending him dailies from some other movie saying, make it more like this. And you know, you're worse than a TV director. And this is literally what they're saying. Wes called me up. He had never heard him so despondent. And we cut it together, sent it to Wes. And, you know, he had one music note. So we changed one piece of temp score and conformed it on film, which you did back then, and sent that with a, you know, single stripe mag to New York. And they watched it and they were like, oh my God, we're so wrong. This works so amazingly well. And we can't believe how wrong we were. We're so sorry. Whatever you need. Suddenly we had money for, you know, there was money to have an orchestra and the score, which we were told we were forbidden to do. So I was, you know, literally cutting the temp track by cutting single piano notes from things and putting them in. And, you know, that 13 minutes changed everything.
Yeah.
Certainly changed everything for me. Personally, my opportunity to direct for Dimension and things like that all came out of that 13 minutes.
Wow.
Going to cut Mimic, everything like that. I think when we were putting Scream together and we first showed it to the studio, they loved it. I think that some people who worked on the film said, well, you know, the mystery works, but I don't think it's very scary. Mm. We showed it to an audience in New Jersey, 450 people, I think. It was huge screening. And 2 minutes in, the killer says, you know, I want to know who I'm looking at. 450 people went, and we're like, I think this might work better than we think it does. And it wasn't until that screening, which was only about, you know, five, six weeks after they stopped shooting. We previewed very early. You know, the director's cut was done about four weeks in. Maybe it was 8 weeks, but by the time we had done the sound and stuff for that. But the reaction was so great, and it scored so high that we went back and tried three different variations of Skeet getting shot at the end, and ended up going with one we previewed, and that was that. The biggest challenge on that film was getting to the MPAA.
Yeah,
they had huge issues. We went back 9 times trying to get the R rating. Not the NC-17. I think on Laserdisc you can find the NC-17 version.
Yeah, I think one VHS might accidentally have shots.
Yeah. And it's not a lot different. The main thing that they wanted, the MPAA wanted, they wanted to get rid of the line of dialogue of we want to movies don't make what is it?
Movies
don't create serial killers. Yeah. Movies make killers more creative.
Yeah, which is like, saying that's it badly. The movie.
Yeah, but that is a concept they hated.
Wow, interesting. How little has changed.
And to Bob Weinstein's credit, you know, he got them to finally give it our rating by going to them and telling them, no, they were watching it wrong and that it was a comedy.
Oh my God. That's like an old Hitchcock trick.
Yeah. No, it's comedy.
Yeah.
Oh. Which it totally is not.
Yeah. We went to Scary Movie for that version eventually.
Yeah. So.
But that's amazing. And I don't think people remember that. It's not like the first Scream was like number one at the box office and a huge hit opening weekend.
No.
It took a long time.
It opened like fourth or fifth. I think it was like
December or something.
Yeah. It was behind One Fine Day, you know, some George Clooney, Michelle Pfeiffer movie. And Beavis and Butthead, which was
America.
Number one. And I think it opened with $6 million, but then I think the next weekend it made something like $9 million. It started going up,
which
doesn't happen.
I know. And especially now it's like studios are so focused on that opening weekend.
Yeah.
Right? So, but you mentioned something great that I wanted to get into was making that transition into directing. So that opening sequence, which is one of the best opening sequences in horror history, opened the door for you as a director. Yeah. Were you always – like vying for that or did it just seem like a natural evolution? Like, you know what? I do want to try this now.
It was something that I'd always wanted to do but didn't want to overly state it because, you know, you always meet some kid comes in and says, well, I'm going to direct. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be the next Steven Spielberg. Now, of course, they probably don't even know who that is. But and you're just sort of roll your eyes and go, let me give you one piece of advice. Never say that.
Yeah.
Ever. But the opportunity to present itself. They Dimension at the time didn't. They wanted me to. It was in between cutting Scream 2 and Halloween H2O, and before Scream 3 was going to start, they were like, you know, we don't want you to go work for anybody else. We'll give you an opportunity to direct one of these because at the time they were doing all these direct-to-video movies. So I did
tons. What was the first one? Was it one of the Prophecies?
Third Prophecy, the last one that had Christopher Walken in it, and Mr. Walken's a hoot to direct. And of course, your first time directing, he can appear to be a little intimidating, but he was great. although I think he did make a Teamster cry on the movie.
Oh really?
but nobody else. Everybody else loved it. but he was, you know, that was a great, great opportunity. It was also a lesson in, you know, we had a really interesting script for that. At about 6 weeks out, they gave us the note that the character who had one line of dialogue in the opening, they wanted to make her the main character. They wanted to get rid of the main character. They wanted to take the hero and make him the villain, get rid of this other villain, take the whole setup of what the thing was and get rid of it. And it was just like, what?
That's more than a note.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was crazy to watch how that sort of completely dissembled.
Yeah.
And I just remember Joel Soussan, the one of the writers and producer of it, and Joel just saying, remember, you just have to love every mutant child.
Yeah, he's somebody I'd love to have an interview with because he was – I mean, was there just a ton of money going around to – like, because at that point, it's like to make those kind of decisions and you're making sequels to like, what do we got? Like, let's make more Mimics. Let's make more Prophecies. Well,
and Joel did all those, right?
Yeah,
Joel was
the
king of that. And I think Joel lives up in the Pacific Northwest now. But you should definitely talk to Joel.
Yeah.
He's tremendously entertaining and very smart and just sort of became – Bob's guy, you know, the dimension guy, for how many Trollen Lacorns do you want?
We got a lot.
Yeah. Or Mimics or Hellraisers or, you know. He did all those films. And proudly and well, you know, and
yeah, some of them are quite good from what I remember.
Yeah, and he wrote a lot of them or rewrote a lot of them. Sort of, you know, he always tried to make, you know, the best version of things. I think you know, Phantoms, which I think is a very underrated film. He produced the one with Peter O'Toole.
I remember Ben Affleck.
He's
the bomb in Phantoms. Yeah,
he's the bomb in Phantoms.
I actually like the first. I want to say the first 15 or 20 minutes of that movie. I was like visiting family in Arizona and I went by myself and there was no one in the theater.
Yeah.
And I found it really creepy. Opening,
it's
15 minutes.
Tremendously successful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Joel had, I guess, done a lot of writing on the screenplay, even though he's not credited for that. And his original ending of that film that he wrote versus what they shot is so much better and made so much more sense. It's reminded me because in this room where we're recording, there's a sign that says LSD. So the original version that he wrote, and Joel may get mad at me for telling the story, but he's not going to get in trouble for telling it, so it doesn't really matter, was that Peter O'Toole's character, being an old sort of Timothy Leary type, rather than, you know, putting together some chemical that eats oil, what he did instead was he made LSD. He made turbo LSD, and that's what – and the end was the way to make the monster go insane is Ben Affleck injected himself with all this stuff and went out and was consumed by the monster. And so it literally goes mad and because it has got so much LSD in its system, and that's what it's – and it's just like – that's brilliant. I totally want to see
awesome.
That. Yeah. So so that was the ending of Phantoms that you never got to see, that Joel Soson wrote.
And, and that was a Dean Koontz book.
It was from a Dean Koontz book. I think Dean is credited with the screenplay as well.
I don't mean to speak ill, but one of my favorite shirts. You know how in Monster Squad it's like Stephen King rules?
Yeah.
The red shirt. I think it's Jonah Ray, the comedian. He's been wearing a shirt that says like – Dean Koontz is all right, I guess. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. There's, you know, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. We probably shouldn't say anything else about that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you also – were you editing in between these directing gigs? Because then you did Dracula 2000, and I didn't realize you did all of those Dracula
movies. I did.
Because I ordered all of them last night.
Oh, my God.
I've never seen 2 and 3. Okay, yeah. Here we go.
Yeah, 2 – it's funny. 2 was – 2 and 3 were made for – very little money. I think below the line, they were like $800,000.
Right, which is a luxury today in independent filmmaking.
Today is, you know, I think about the, you know, going back to the Halloween 3D thing that Todd and I didn't get to make. The reason was is that they wanted to make it for $10 million and the budget was 12, and we're like, we don't know how to make it in 3D for that price now. I just think that is the stupidest thing ever. It's just like, fuck, you want to make it for 5? We'll do it for that.
Yeah.
Or we'll make it for 3. We'll make it for 2. How about 1? We'll make it for free. The two little sequels were fun to do, and the second one, the swimming pool story, was sort of the original concept, although very, very abridged for Dracula 2000, because it originally was about thieves who steal Dracula's body to sell immortality. They didn't care that he was Dracula. Dracula cared that he was Dracula. And then it went wildly off the rails and turned into the movie that we made as it was developed into – whatever it was.
Were you doing those all back to back, the Dracula
movies? I would edit in between different things, and so I did the first one and then edited for a while on a movie called My Boss's Daughter for Dimension, which was an Ashton Kutcher movie that's not very good. Tara Reid, a big classic film.
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, exactly. Terrence Stamp is very fun in it. Did a few weeks of editing uncredited for Scary Movie 2.
That's got to be weird. Editing the real series and then
it was so strange and so insane, like just hemorrhaging money. I remember being finished on it right as they were about to start shooting their Marlon Brando
cameo. Yeah, because the opening was Marlon Brando, the last minute James Woods came in.
They shot the Marlon Brando.
Ooh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the film was destroyed.
Wow.
Because they shot it, I think, the day before he died.
Oh my God.
And I think they destroyed it.
Wait, he was on set the day before he died shooting freaking Scary Movie? Or they destroyed it?
No, he was on set the day before. It's my understanding.
Wow. So you saw that footage?
I did not see that footage. I had left just before that to go do this other thing, and then left that in those two movies to go to the two little Dracula sequels, 2 and 3. The Jason Scott Lee masterpieces. So.
Wow. What a time. What a time.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Well, so here's what I really got to get into. So believe it or not, I think the last 3D advocate in the world. I have a 3D TV. I love it more than anything in the world. I think home 3D is better than theatrical 3D.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And here's a great example is they stopped making them, I think, in 2016. So I literally got the last one and I'm hoping it lasts me a couple more years because I just have so many at this point. I don't know what to do with them. But the point being is when I bring people over and convince them on home 3D, I show them several things. I do the T-Rex scene from the original Jurassic Park, which looks great. And I show them the opening of My Bloody Valentine 3D.
Oh, yeah.
All the way through to basically when the pickaxe comes towards the screen and lands right in there. And the point being is I look at this and I was like, this guy gets 3D. He made this movie knowing. And I think I saw it in theaters in 3D. I think it looks better at home than it did my experience in the theater seeing in 3D. I can't explain it. I guess maybe.
The explanation is at the time, that was the early days of 3D. We shot native 3D. So we actually shot with 3D cameras. Part of it is not everybody's exhibition is the same, right? There's a lot of things that are out of whack. There's a lot of – at the time. The screening that Ryan did, hosted of My Bloody Valentine at the ArcLight in Sherman Oaks, it was out of focus. I went up to the booth and tried to beg them to – and they said, no, that's just the 3D. It's like I made this movie. I'm telling you it is out of focus. I know exactly. No, that's just the 3D. That's like – fuck you, it is not.
Wow.
But anyways, they never changed it. So I just fumed out in the lobby. But yeah, it's a three – yeah. Sorry?
Well, basically, so I guess my question or point is, between that and Drive Angry 3D, which I also have on home 3D, I've never seen a modern director get – a grasp of the format as well, except, and this is great company, Scorsese's Hugo is like, you put that on in a home 3D setup and within 5 minutes, you're like, oh, he is totally thinking exactly about how this looks in 3D. But again, it's like most people just do things poking at you or whatever the case is, but you fully utilize 3D. Everything from like the opening title sequence where it's like newspapers telling you about Harry Warden coming at you in the letters and everything and then the pickaxe. And it's just, it blows me away. So you must have had, basically I'm saying that it seems like you found this new skill and you were really damn good at it. So,
which turned out to be utterly useless. It's like I make the world's best 8-track tapes.
But you know what? Some of us love 8-track.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing better than having a change song, right? Change tracks right in the middle of a song. Yeah. Well, it's a skill.
But did you have fun experimenting with that?
Yeah. I mean, when we got on My Bloody Valentine, I got that job because I was recutting and directing, I guess we did 40 pages of reshoots on the Jessica Alba movie.
Yeah.
Because it was in some trouble. And when I was showing, a revised cut of that was, something that would be releasable as opposed to the original version. And to Mike Pasternak and Peter Block and John Sackey. And that was the day they closed the deal on the rights for My Bloody Valentine.
Wow.
which was part of the reason they took the eye from Paramount, where it was originally made. Where it was originally set up was they wanted My Bloody Valentine because Mike had worked on the original. And they were like, hey, you want to direct My Bloody Valentine? Yes, my God, I totally do.
Wow.
And then a few weeks later, it's like, hey, you want to make it in 3D? Absolutely. I know nothing about 3D. but we did a lot of homework and met with all the three primary 3D companies at the time, Pace, Threality, and Paradise, who we ended up going with, who were sort of the cowboys in the group. And a lot of it was both pace and reality, there was very strict rules about what you could and couldn't do. You could see why they were really using a lot of it on stage work and on using it for concert footage. You know, the U2 3D movie had been done and stuff like that. I remember having a conversation with the reality where it was like, well, you know, you can't get the mirrors bloody or anything like that. You can't take it underground. You shouldn't do it on location. It's like, we had 4 days on set. We shot underground in a real mine for 11 days. I mean, it's just like, that's not going to work. And Paradise were like, yeah, we'll figure it out. You can do anything. Yeah. and there wasn't a day on that shoot where they're like, oh, nobody's done this before. And they built – the rigs were built the day before we started shooting of how the rigs work, because they were made – so the way they work is you have one camera pointing into a mirror shooting its reflection and the other one pointing – shooting through the mirror, because it's like a half-coated, you know, cup, the interview room mirror.
Yeah.
and then you adjust the interocular of how close or farther apart they are to live as you're shooting, depending on how close to an object you are and how much depth you want it to be.
Wow.
So you have somebody who's pulling 3D as well as somebody who's pulling focus. So that's happening live within the shot. So the shots that we would go out of our way to create these really dynamic 3D shots. Max Penner, our stereographer, is great, sort of brilliant, mad genius. We'd pull 3D and we'd talk about this, and he's like, "Well, if you pull that hand, that bloody hand, so far out, you're, I worry about what you're going to cut to next." I said, "Well, don't worry about it, because I'm going to dissolve to something next." Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah, that you should be able to do. And then we just decided. You know, there was no rules, because we had been told there were so many rules. Like, oh, you can't shoot through chain link fences or anything like that. Totally did that.
You did all of it.
Yeah. You can't do that. Oh, I totally did that. We would pick locations that had tunnels, because anything that had lots of depth, like the grocery store in Valentine, that was a huge thing, because of we picked a grocery store that was incredibly – had long aisles, because that worked for that. Shooting in the real mine and all the textures of that. The movie I always feel is a little brightly lit, but part of that is so you can see it in 3D.
Oh, yeah. That's the one comment, like, when I show people the opening is like, wait, I see everything. I'm like, yeah, but you're not in the mind.
Right.
Of course, you see them all there.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. So that was the because the cameras were very early red cameras.
Yeah.
And the amount of light you needed like three times the light to get the exposure and things like that.
Sure.
You know, if I was to do one now, I'd do it a little differently. But at the time, you were just it just took forever because of the amount of lights you had. And, you know, you're shooting in a real mine. You're not flying walls or doing anything. It's just you're dragging these massive lights underground through mud and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, of course, the fight scene with Red and the miner and Harry Warden has a clearance. The part of the mine we shot it in has a clearance of probably like 5.5. So you're shooting a pickaxe fight, and it's like, you know, it's just there it is. That's what it is. So, you know, it was a crazy thing to do, but you start learning very quickly what has texture. What is one of the most educational things when we were in prep was going to see the Miley Cyrus the 3D movie. Best
of
Both.
That's prepped.
Because part of what it did showed us in the 3D and how the 3D worked was that, okay, because they had different things of confetti and stuff like that, of just watching how things interact in 3D. It was really informative to then go, okay, how do we push that even further? Mm. How can we exploit really the beauty of 3D? Because it is a beautiful format.
Yeah. No, I mean, things like fire ambers or dust in the – like, it always looks amazing if you get it right. And look, the movie's a lot of fun. I mean, it feels like the original movie, which didn't get the due it deserved, I thought.
I agree.
It was a hit, right? Yeah, it did. I remember
it did okay. I mean, part of the challenge that they had with the original My Bloody Valentine is that it was released not long after John Lennon was shot. So they gutted the violence in the film.
Yeah.
So it doesn't – things don't track quite as well as they might, as they certainly if you see the restored version.
Yeah, the uncut one is amazing.
Yeah, like you see that, you totally get it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's one of the Canadian tax shelter horror movies, of which there are many. And growing up in Canada, was very aware of those films, the magical forbidden fruit of the Canadian slasher film.
Well, I would say, to me, the ultimate test of a remake is if you can do a double bill with the original and it not feel like the exact same movie and complement each other, then you made a great remake.
Yeah.
And so every year, whatever, every February 14th, I'll do the uncut original and then the 3D one. And now I've mixed it up. I like to do the 3D one first and then the uncut original.
Yeah.
And it always plays as a very, very fun double bill. But how far did you, cause you and Todd, I know Todd has talked about this a lot, but I want the dirt. Like, how far did the sequel get? Because you guys obviously had something for My Bloody Valentine 2.
Well, we have like a scriptment for the whole thing. So it's probably 30, 40 pages that has dialogue and things like that. We knew what the story was. Had sort of a huge opening. The opening took place immediately after it, like Axel being brought to the hospital.
Who's, by the way, probably the greatest asshole villain? Hero. Yeah. He's technically the hero,
Technically the hero, but yeah,
he's such a scumbag.
It was funny as we were going, in my mind, and it's why the movie ends the way the movie ends, Tom is the hero. He was the hero.
Well, what's fun about it is every time I revisit it, I totally forget who the killer is. I don't know why. Like, I start watching it, and it's like The Thing. Every time I watch The Thing, I'm like, who's The Thing again in this movie? I can't remember.
Yeah.
But like, I get wrapped up in it because of how complex those characters are.
And
or maybe subliminally, I want it to be Axel.
Because we certainly tee it up that you don't like him.
Yeah.
And he has motive.
Oh, yeah.
Tom's motive is – and Tom is hidden in plain sight. You know, the cage sequence, that was a sequence that, in the middle where he has the face off with the miner.
Yeah.
And he's stuck in the cage where we had a lot of people like, oh, you can't do that. And then people came in to try and rewrite it and cut it out. And I kept putting it back in. I said, trust me, this will totally work.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to see it. And then that to me is like one of my favorite sequences in the movie because I think it's, again, he's the hero of the story. He just happens to carry the villain around with him.
Wow.
So the opening of the sequel was him in the hospital, like, Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, sewing himself up and Sarah Palmer goes into another room to try and call her son, and he's in there. Mm. And it ends with her – opens with her getting killed and Axel watching it through a door that he can't get through.
Oh, wow.
Then you cut to years later. They don't know what's happened to him and it's but that was the opening. And then it had crazy things. Mayhem ensues.
And I assume you would see the miner again because that's
– Oh, yes.
I think that might be the one thing about My Bloody Valentine original and this one is like it's the miner – And you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't want to see a sequel where it's like the guy unmasked and now we follow that.
No, the miner, we had a way to bring the miner back very viciously. Mm. There are moments where you see Tom and the miner together, like we already had set up in the first one. Mm. There are moments where they are the same and then there were moments where they were not the same. Mm. So there was all sorts of things that we did to make that work. The secret cult of Harry Warden. Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. It's funny. Yeah, I think last I heard, the director of the original movie is trying to make a direct sequel to his.
Yeah, I think he's been trying to do that for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, George Mahalkar.
Cool. Yeah. I welcome more Harry Warden.
Way to do it. More Valentine Bluffs or Harmony, Pennsylvania, whichever it is. If he makes it, I'll be there opening night.
Yeah. I have to ask this now. So how far – you guys were super close to Halloween 3D.
Yeah.
The continuation. Yeah. I mean it's fun to look at it now because there's now this new iteration happening with our friend Ryan.
Yeah.
I like Rob Zombie as a personality. I don't know how I feel about him as a filmmaker, to be candid. So I don't know if I – Joe, I definitely don't like his Halloween movies. I'll put it to you that way.
Yeah.
There's interesting things about them. So to pick up the baton from what he set up, which is such a quote unquote Rob Zombie world.
Yeah.
Like, how would you and Todd have done it? And was this in between Drive Angry and My
Yeah.
Movie? So you're going to do it in between those
yeah,
two
we, as I said, it was written. We had it designed to be shot in Shreveport, the same place we were going to shoot Drive Angry. So while it was finishing, it was cut that we were going to be in prep on the other thing and scouting. And we had locations in Shreveport already picked. We had
– man.
You know, it was all laid out to work. We had talked to the producers of both films. They were on board and – yeah, it was interesting that it didn't happen, but we were very far down the road with it. And you know, we had seen both of Rob's movies, you know, the zombie movies and that's just my phone falling on the floor. and had a, you know, like what he had done in a lot of different ways. You know, he'd created his own version of it. Like he decided to own it, and you gotta respect that.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think Kevin Williamson always had a great comment on them that the thing that he always loved about Carpenter's original, which he clearly loved, you know, that's, you know, writing of Scream and certainly the rewriting he did in Halloween H2O, which is very much a mirror of the original and how much he adored it, or still does. Was that the second you explain Michael Myers and give him motive, the second you let the audience have empathy for him, the less scary he becomes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. When you understand what a horrible life he has as a kid and the evil stepfather and stuff like that.
Well, that version, let's be clear.
Well, that version. Yes, yes. That version. So that, but that's the version we were entering into.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So our goal was within the first big opening set piece that we had was to set all that on fire. Mm-hmm. Literally, I think the end of it was Laurie ends up shooting Brackett in the head and she ends up in an insane asylum and we have a new hero that we introduce who's inside an ambulance, and Michael Myers is trying to get her inside the ambulance as the ambulance is on fire. And the ambulance, she ends up climbing up to the windshield. The ambulance goes over the side, you know, into like a dam or some ludicrous thing. And that was how it started. So it was literally the erasing is the wrong word, but sort of the setting ablaze what had been done before so that we could come back in a way that was more in tune with both Halloween and Halloween 2, you know, John's original movies.
Well, I think the way Todd described it was you saw Michael Myers in the Rob Zombie ones. We want to see the shape.
Yeah.
We want to bring it back.
Well, and because there was a point where one of the best moments that would have been in the movie is that, you know, you see him get the new, like the original Michael Myers mask, you know, from a Halloween store when he comes back. And I think it was a 3D kill where he was killing somebody with a side view mirror and pummeling them in the face with it over and over so that each time you hit it, the object in the mirror is close to their appearance. He was smacking, he was killing them with it. It was a great 3D death. There's a point later where, you know, he has the, you know, the traditional Michael Myers mask on and the traditional sort of thing, you know, the William Shatner version. And the hero of the story rips it off and you see the old Rob Zombie mask is melted into his face.
Yeah.
That Michael Myers doesn't exist anymore. It is only the shape.
Yeah.
That image I thought would have been, you know, worth the price of admission.
Well, I actually like his second one a lot more because it's more his own thing. And the thing I loved was that the mask was like half falling off and you could see Tyler. And basically it's like there is no difference now in Halloween 2.
Right.
With who he is. And, you know, Todd's good friends with Tyler Mayne.
Yeah. Yeah. So. They're very good friends. Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
You guys were going to bring Tom Atkins back for that. I just want to talk about, did you bring him out of retirement for My Bloody Valentine? Is that how the story goes?
Yeah.
Because he's in your new movie, by the way.
He is. I met it was during the prep on My Bloody Valentine that Tom Piccarelli, who a horror author who passed away a couple years ago, of cancer, unfortunately. And Tom had Piccirilli had said, you know, Tom Atkins lives in Pittsburgh where you're shooting. You should get in contact with him, put him in the movie. It's like, Tom Atkins? Oh my God, I love Tom Atkins. You know, talked to local casting, said, hey, can we bring Tom in? At the time, we were in the process of, you know, two other writers had come in and had done a little rewrite on the film, and they, we were making more of the Burke part, the sheriff part. Originally, he died in the opening, and then we were making it longer. And the second that happened, I was just like, we should cast Tom Atkins for that. So they set up a meeting. I meet Tom Atkins downtown and instantly fell in love with him. And just like we've been fast friends ever since. And he was like, yeah, absolutely, I'll do that. And, you know, he had so much fun in his death scene where we rip his jaw off. I just remember him, you know, laughing hysterically at it afterwards as he was, you know, blood all over the place. He just thought that was great. And you know, we write all the time and see each other when we can. And so we just – everything that certainly Todd and I have done, and we try and see, okay, where can we put Tom in?
Yeah.
What can we write for Tom? So certainly, you know, he was in Drive Angry as Cap at the roadblock. And then we, when in Trick, we wrote this part very specifically for Tom.
Yeah.
And, you know, that in all the casting that we did, he, you know, he was just like, well, this is, it has to be Tom. It can't be anybody else. I'm like, well, what about, no, it has to be. and luckily, you know, the everybody else got on board really quickly and saw the merit of Tom having him in it. And he had so much fun doing it.
It's just always like I get we did a panel with him, me and Ryan and the rest of the Shockwaves crew at like a Halloween thing last year. He's just always fun to be around. Yeah. He's got that energy.
Yeah.
There's even a bit in – there's a documentary about Jamie Lee Curtis going back to the conventions.
Yeah.
And the moment she sees Tom for the first time, she's like, like it's like magic. It's like he has that effect on everybody.
He totally
even
does.
One of the biggest movie stars on the planet.
Yeah, and because he is – so charming and genuine and just a beautiful human. And if you ever get a chance to see his, I think there's, it was recorded so you can rent it or watch it on Amazon. His one man show of the Chief. About the founder of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he is so good because it's just him talking for 90 minutes all about, you know, Pittsburgh and in this play. And he is amazing.
Oh, I'm definitely going to watch that.
Yeah. It's just – you can't get enough Tom Atkins.
I'd watch him read the phone book,
frankly. Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, he – when this came on and we were like, you know, we have him there. He was only there for a few days, but it was a huge impact to have him. You know, the older you get, the more you realize how important it is to have older actors in your work.
Oh yeah,
and have that voice and that image of somebody who's so charming and charismatic and capable. And you know, there was a scene that in the film in Trick where he catches these four kids sneaking into the back of this church. Where they're playing Night of the Living Dead. And you know, it's not ultimately the movie, but they did several takes where these, you know, younger actors tried to sort of out-ad-lib him.
Ah.
And he clobbered them.
Every time.
He was so – it's just like you couldn't – he was so much funnier and so much faster. And he was just – they were speechless because he could just nail it.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Well, another regular that you have on board with Trick is Gary Tunnelcliffe, who does some pretty gnarly – I mean, that's the thing I like about this movie a lot is it's pretty gory. I mean, you guys go for some pretty graphic kills.
I think there's something like 9 kills in the first 13 minutes or something like that.
I counted that, yes. Yeah, so I was like, holy shit. Am I like 15 minutes in?
Yeah, we sort of decided that, you know, taking that lesson from My Bloody Valentine, where the title told us everything is when you're going to do it, you might as well lean in.
Yeah.
You know, don't lean away from the precipice. Lean as far over it as you can.
Yeah.
Dangle your feet into the abyss.
So what's it like working with him? Is it, does I mean, are those things scripted? Do you talk to Gary? Does he come up with fun, radical ways?
It's a combination of things with Gary. So we'll have a version that's scripted, and then Gary and I will talk through the other different possibilities. Then the location will inform us of different things. And then, and then we'll talk with stunts, and then we'll go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth in a roundabout about how we'll do it. And sometimes I'll be like, well, I really thought it could be this. And what about this? And he'll always give you more than you ask for. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great, really fun relationship working with Gary on that, because because you're just spitballing murder.
Yes.
wouldn't it be fun if, or what if, and then you could, and yeah, it's, I think if anybody was listening to the conversation, we'd both end up in jail, but yeah.
The blood quotient from My Bloody Valentine to Trick, did you use about the same amount of gallons of blood?
I think we probably used more in Valentine only because of that hospital scene at the beginning.
Yeah.
Which is just, because that was a closed wing of the hospital, we just hosed it. Like, he just went crazy in there. He said, can I do anything? And I said, yep. They said, you can do anything. And they the people who own the hospital had no idea.
Wow.
What? Yeah. And it's all sort of maple syrup based. So it was very, very, like a pancake breakfast gone bad.
Wow. So I have one more before we wrap up. This is just more of a fan curiosity for me. We're on the verge of a new Terminator movie. Right? So we haven't talked about Patrick Lussier, the writer.
Oh, God.
Okay. Yeah. But
let's talk.
I am so intimidated by this franchise because they keep trying to bring it back one way or another.
Mm.
You as a director, an editor, writer, somebody comes to you and says, hey, we want you to write the new Terminator.
Right.
I mean, I would be like, yep, it's Terminator. Sure. Yeah. I'll figure it out.
As a matter of fact, exactly how it went down.
But now take me, what happens next? Do they then say to you, okay, you got to bring Arnold back somehow?
Well, to me, it was
we're talking about Terminator Genesis, by the way.
Yeah, Terminator Genesis. You weren't going to do it without Arnold.
Right.
It was funny, the note on the very first draft that I did with my co-writer on that was, there's too much Arnold and Arnold's the hero, which after, of course, we previewed the version that was ultimately made where they're like, wow, Arnold scores higher than everybody. It's like, gee, only we have more Arnold. And of course, in the original version, all the hanging chads that were left at the end of the movie, all those were explained.
Mm.
Like you knew where he came from. You knew everything was explained.
But Patrick, we're making a new trilogy here.
You're right, right. And of course, the best way to make a new trilogy is not ever say you're making one, and don't actually, Star Wars is complete on its own.
The first
one.
Of course, yeah, totally.
So, if that's how it ended, with just Darth Vader rolling into space, like, what does the robot chicken say? Like, feet wrapped in burnt bacon. then that would be great. But that was not the decision on this. So, it was an interesting process. It was, director who had, certainly mixed feelings about the script and the original version of the script, the studio and everybody really loved. I think it got sort of squished down and over-explained and all sorts of things. Anyway, those are all excuses. There are lots of great things that I like about that movie.
I have it in 3D.
the things I love most about that movie are all the sequences with Arnold. I think he is far and away the most interesting thing. I love the whole, old but not obsolete.
Yeah.
Storyline, and when his hands are slowing down, everything of that. I remember writing those scenes and just, it's. The older you get, the more that begins to ring true.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, I still have value. It's just like, yes, but you're not 25 years old and 300,000 Instagram followers, who wants you?
Yeah. Oh, God. I feel obsolete now.
Yeah. So, you know, but that's so that all was certainly going on in my mind at the time of being involved in that. So,
well, I think the funnest thing is going back into the original movie and having that.
Well, that was the original pitch. Yeah. That's how we pitched, was the Arnold on Arnold fight.
Yeah.
And that was, and I remember coming up with it the morning before we went in and telling my co-writer about it, not knowing whether she would pitch it or not, because she was actually, you know, being the vocal on that pitch. And then actually doing it, she was like, "Well, I don't know if that's going to work." And then that was the sell for the movie. That was the sell for us writing it. Was that Arnold fighting Arnold? And because it was more than just the old Terminator fighting the young Terminator. It was very meta in so many different ways. It went so much beyond of all the ways, you know, Arnold had become beaten up because of his, you know, a bit of a scandal and things like that he was involved in, and you know, all that stuff that happened to him, all the stuff that happened, you know, he's governor and then and coming back into this franchise and all those components. Arnold fighting Arnold, you know, the older version fighting the younger version, just felt like that's what the movie was about. That was the theme of fighting that part of yourself that that has a mythology that you can no longer live up to. So how do you kill it so you can actually keep going?
Yeah, no, it's cool. It's a cool sequence, and I'm actually cautiously optimistic about the new one.
I too. I think.
Tim, I like seeing Linda.
Yeah, and Tim is a brilliant director.
Yeah,
Tim Miller is a great, great director. Incredibly skilled. I thought what he did with Deadpool was great. I thought some of the things that I've seen, you know, the previous stuff he and Blur did for other films that have not been made, including Snow Crash and other things that are long passion projects of his, are unlike anything you've seen. You know, he is a brilliant director.
Wow. Well, you're not so bad yourself, and you have a new movie called Trick, which is out October 18th.
October 18th.
So everyone check it out, especially if you love things like My Bloody Valentine, Drive Angry, and just stuff in general in that Scream, again, a more serious version of kind of the Scream era.
Yeah.
This delivers the goods. So thank you so much for spending some time with me, and everyone check out Trick on October 18th.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. All right, see ya.
This episode is brought to you by Severn Films. Severn Films presents a trio of Euro Terrors on Blu-ray for Halloween. From the director of Contamination and Star Crash, Luigi Cozzi, comes Paganini Horror, starring Dario Nicoletti and Donald Pleasence. This is the first official release ever in America, limited edition 3,000 copies, and it comes with a remastered soundtrack CD. Also for the first time in America, the 1961 Italian lycanthrope classic Werewolf in a Girl's Dormitory, Director's Cut, limited edition of 3,000 with vintage comic book reprint and soundtrack CD. The extras include a commentary with star Kurt Lowens and an interview with screenwriter Ernesto Gastaldi. And finally, another U.S. distribute, the hot German cut of Eurocult Sleazathon, Belith, the Demon of Incest, never before in HD and never forgotten one scene. Get all three on Blu-ray from SeverinFilms.com in a special bundle or separately. That's www.severin-films.com. Follow Severin Films on social media for the new release announcements and all these special offers. This week's episode is also sponsored by our friends at RLJE Films. Don't miss the terrifying thriller Mary, starring Gary Oldman and Emily Mortimer. Mary is coming to select theaters, VOD, and digital today, Friday, October 11th, and is available now on Apple TV. Check out Mary.